त्यागुदाम तोय नरसानी जब जराया फरेर फानी.
At Insight Myanmar, we strive to highlight the resilience and struggles of the Burmese people as they navigate extraordinary challenges in their fight for justice and freedom. Through their stories, we witness acts of courage and determination, but also the complexities, hardships, and uncertainties that come with such a monumental struggle. Our role is not to romanticize or idealize, but to amplify authentic voices, foster understanding, and create space for deeper reflection. The people of Myanmar lead their own fight for dignity and human rights, and we stand alongside them in solidarity, sharing their experiences and perspectives with the world.
Joined today by Noor, who is an interview that has been some time in the making. We will be discussing the Rohingya genocide from a number of different angles and the subsequent fallout to that genocide and various activities and operations that are being undertaken to support the Rohingya community, a shocking number of whom, as we will discover in this interview, are living in either camps around the world or living in hiding because they still do not have access to basic legal representation and recognition that they should. But before we get into all of those details, Noor, thank you very much for joining us and for sharing your insights. And I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself for the audience.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Noor Aziza. I'm a Rohingya genocide survivor. I lead an organization called Rohingya Mayafwanar Collaborative Network. So Mayafwanar just means women in our language. And we are a refugee-led, Rohingya-led, women-led organization comprising of 13 Rohingya women genocide survivors. And we fight for the rights of our people and our community.
Excellent, excellent. It's good to hear that there is a lot of work being done, that there is support being provided, and there is advocacy being done, because the Rohingya, once again, are sort of slipping out of, I think, the cultural awareness when we talk about Myanmar, that the focus is always on the ongoing conflict domestically. So let's talk about that, because, of course, the relationship between the Rohingya and the Arakan was not always as bad as it has been over the last few decades. So what can you tell us, what started this animosity between the Rohingya and the Arakan, and what started the animosity between the Rohingya and Myanmar as a country, and how did that devolve into the point of a full-scale genocide?
Yeah, so the Rohingya have faced genocide, displacement, and violence for nearly up to 84 years now. And it started in 1942, where the Japanese forces brought the Rakhine ethnic group and caused tensions amongst Rohingya and Rakhine ethnic group. And we lived side by side in peace, despite having different religions, different cultures, different languages. We were essentially like cousins. But then, because the animosity grew and the English used Rohingya as pawns and promised us our own land and so on, there were massacres against Rohingya in 1942 by the Japanese and Rakhine ethnic group. Eventually, because of successive colonial and post-colonial laws, it became a full-on brutal genocide. Over the years, since 1962, when Nguyen's military coup took over Myanmar, we saw violence increase. And because we saw violence increase, we saw more movements of Rohingya escaping from Myanmar to neighboring countries, such as Bangladesh, which today is housing the largest refugee camp in the world. More than 1 million Rohingya refugees live there. About 700,000 of them escaped in 2017 when the Myanmar junta carried out Operation Clearance, which they said they were combating terrorism, but they were also burning down villages, burning children to the ground, throwing children inside fires alive. So right now we are hearing testimonies from survivors because the ICJ case is ongoing and the hearing is happening this week. In 2017, more than 25,000 Rohingya women were raped, gang raped. In 1982, they removed our citizenship, which rendered us the largest stateless people in the entire world, having no land despite us being indigenous to our ancestral homeland. There were also evidence to say that the military encouraged Rakhine ethnic group during the 2017 genocide to sharpen their knives and to sharpen every tool they have at home to kill the animals away. So they didn't even refer to us as Rohingya. They referred to us as animals. They even armed Rakhine ethnic household with knives and weapons before they orchestrated the violence. They provided tools such as knives, sharp tools, to make sure that when Rohingya were escaping their household, they were also targeted by their neighbors. So today it's a full-blown genocide, and the genocide is still ongoing. And there are about 3 million Rohingya. Within 3 million, only 1% live in relative freedom and carry an identity, and I'm part of that 1%.
And so I'm sure this is all coming out as a result of the ICJ case, but as to what the Rohingya suffered, the various horrors of the assaults and the attacks and the destruction of the villages and the rapes and the murders, that I would imagine there are a lot of eyewitness testimonies that we can call upon. But as to the question of what it was that the Myanmar military did, as you say, providing weapons and obviously on the propaganda side of things, we're very clear about the propaganda. I'm sure we're going to get into that. How do we know what the military and the regime were doing to inflame animosities and to arm people? Are there people among the Arakan who have turned around and said, no, I was there, I saw this, they contacted me, they provided weapons to me, I want to give testimony? Or are we mostly relying on sort of internal documents that have leaked?
Yes. So again, they did use hate speech, misinformation, disinformation against Rohingya, and they used Rakhine ethnic group to create the segregation. And we also forget that there are also economic incentives behind this genocide, and there are several states that are contributing and funding this genocide. For example, China building the Chokpyu pipeline in 2017 during the genocide, which still exists till today, which goes from the bottom of Rakhine State all the way across to China, where they are transporting oil and goods and services because we are landlocked. Now, because the military deliberately manufactured hatred through propaganda, such as state media on Facebook in particular, military spokesperson. We can also speak about the extremist Buddhist groups, Mabata, Sitagul, Saida. They spread dehumanizing narratives, portraying Rohingya as illegal migrants, Bengalis, these boogeymen that arrived after the English colonial period, terrorists, and they saw this as a threat to Buddhism and national identity, which is why the Burmanization started occurring since 1942. Now, later investigations showed that this wasn't random misinformation. It was coordinated campaigns. There was someone from high above giving instructions and commands to military, to Buddhist extremist groups to conduct the very violence. So this violence is not occurring at just one time. It's happening because there is a chain of command that's occurring. And Facebook also became the main news source in Myanmar. And beyond the Rakhine ethnic group, which you referred to as Arakan, because Arakan is in the Rohingya language and Rakhine is in the Rakhine ethnic group, so I'm going to refer to them as Rakhine ethnic group. Mm-hmm. Beyond the Rakhine ethnic group, the entire country were falling for the hate speech. They received a large amount of domestic support, and this was documented in the United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar, which stated that the hate speech was intentional. It was amplified by military actors and extremist Buddhist groups to prepare the ground for violence. So when violence do occur against Rohingya in Myanmar, then the wider country, the domestic, will not even bat an eyelid because it's been normalized. They've seen that Rohingya are being dehumanized in the media, calling us animals, thorns, black refugees, Bengalis. So we are being compared to anything that is not human. And it's science to say that people will not react when they've been told that this group of people are not human. And the military engineered the division on the ground way before the 2017 genocide. They imposed apartheid-like policies. Like I said, the Rohingya citizenship restriction of movement. For example, there was a testimony where a military officer went inside a Rohingya house in the village and he was counting how many family members there were in the household. And the father and the son were missing because they could have been shopping for food or in the backyard playing soccer. But if they're not in the house, they're not accounted for. And if they're found moving around from village to village and they're not in whatever book they're saving Rohingya in, then they could be killed or detained. And we can talk about the banning of education, healthcare, and something that I feel passionately about because people don't speak about it, is the most gendered genocide of our time. They truly utilized rape as a weapon of war and used Rohingya women to humiliate us and to make sure that we never come back home when we escape.
I mean, it's horrifying, the things that you're talking about, and it reminded me, there's a documentary that it's still on YouTube if people want to watch it, called We Were Neighbors, that looks at a very similar situation in the Balkans between Bosnian Muslim and Croatian Catholic neighbors within a village who over the course of about a year devolve until eventually the Croatian military just comes in and destroys all of the Bosnians' homes, and they have to flee. It's horrific to see how quickly it's possible to turn a group of people against another group of people that they lived alongside and they lived with, and how they will engage with that. And so one question that I have on this, which it's more of a clarification here. You talk about the military doing these things. I want to understand what the relationship was between the military and the Arakan or Rakhine groups or armed groups. Were they in complete coordination with one another? Did the military take over and the Rakhine, for their part, just sort of sat back and let it happen. What was the reality there? Were the Rakhine leading the charge against the Rohingya, or were they just indifferent to it?
That's a really good question. And just to give you a bit of context about the denial of the Rohingya genocide and the brainwashing that the military has done against Rohingya, last year I was in the Philippines and I met I was there for some groundwork looking at some of the reconciliation process in the southern Philippines, in Muslim Mindanao. And my partner organization asked me, are you open to meeting two Rakhine ethnic groups to start the truth-telling process? And I said, yeah, of course, I'm more than happy to meet with two Rakhine ethnic brothers and sisters. And then we met, and I can tell the partner organization was a little bit worried if we were going to disagree. But of course, we were being very respectful, and they were very respectful as well. And when we had a conversation amongst human rights groups, when we spoke about the Rohingya genocide, my partner and I, Yasminullah, the one particular person said, I've never heard about the Rohingya genocide, even though I've lived in Rakhine State for so long. I didn't know that this was happening. And I don't know what to say to that. I think everyone sort of froze when he said that, because we were at the Philippines Human Rights Commission, and this is a very well-documented genocide. Mm. We're not just saying this out of our heads. This is the UN, this is the ICJ, fact-finding mission, Human Rights Watch. And to hear that was just so, I don't even know how to explain it. I was wondering if he truly believed that, or he's accepted the fact that the violence against Rohingya is okay because we're seen as threats. But back to your question about the Arakan Army, unfortunately, the Arakan Army have conducted the recent genocidal violence in the last year and a half, and they haven't been friends with the Rohingya. And they claim to fight for Myanmar. And what we've seen is more than 180,000 Rohingya refugees had to flee in the last year and a half. And we've been collecting testimonies. And some of the testimonies are just so harrowing. I was in the Rohingya refugee camp last year, like 4 months ago, and a Rohingya woman, she was about 23. She had a little child. He was 3 years of age. His name was Abdulrahman. And he was trying to walk, and I realized he didn't have a leg. And I asked her what happened, and she said the Arakan Army went inside her household, shot his leg, and then shot his father in front of him. She grabbed her son and ran for her life across the border while he was bleeding. And now this three-year-old boy is paying the cost of what the Arakan Army are conducting. Some of the Rohingya refugees told me the Arakan Army are much worse than the military junta. I think it's important to listen to that. So the Myanmar military, known as the Tatmadaw, and the Arakan Army, they're not allies. They're rivaled armed forces fighting for control of Rakhine State, known as Arakan State. And the Arakan Army has over 90% of control today. But this didn't mean freedom for our people. This meant more violence, increased violence. They've fought each other for years. That fighting has intensified. Last year, we had an event in Chiang Mai at a beautiful Burmese sister's shop. It was like a restaurant, and we held a cultural night. We had a truth-telling reconciliation process dialogue, some of the work that we do in the region. And she came up to us and said, oh, things are looking really good in Arakan State for you guys. And we're like, no, that's not true, because people are thinking because the Arakan army has taken over control. And yeah, so we tell people about the recent violence that has been committed against our people, because it's really crucial that the public understands that this is becoming a poly crisis, and Rohingya are being scapegoated. And right now, the killings and the violent attacks on Rohingya villages are still ongoing. And we are responding to so many of the families that have arrived in the last year and a half. We've had to provide aid to more than 3,000 families.
Well, that's, I mean, the scale of the crisis is, I think, something that people don't really appreciate or understand, just because it's difficult. I think genocide in general is something that I think people don't understand. We fortunately have very few genocides. They're very rare events, and more often than not, they happen quite far away from where we are. And just to your point on the person in Mindanao who said that he didn't know anything about the genocide, I'm European. After World War II, you had a lot of civilian populations saying, well, we didn't know what was going on in the camps. And then you're like, but my brother, the ash from the crematorium snowed on your village regularly. You must have had some concept of what was going on. You can't be that stupid. But either as a mental block to not have to take responsibility for complicity, or as simply a way of trying to shirk, legal repercussions. I think there's a very high mental incentive to believe that you didn't know what was happening, to believe that you didn't have a responsibility to act. It was I think it was Milgram who conducted experiments after World War II specifically to try to understand how people could go along with the Holocaust, and he developed the concept of an agentic profile, agentic mindset. As long as you can convince yourself that you were doing what you were told to do, and you were not making any decisions that made anyone suffer, you yourself have no moral blame. And I think from what you're saying, it just sounds to me like there are a lot of people who want to have the peace of mind to convince themselves that they have nothing to be ashamed of and that they have nothing to atone for because they didn't do anything,
Yeah, and on a brighter note, ever since the military coup, the only positive thing I've seen is that slowly people are realizing that perpetrators were never the Rohingya. And you probably already know that even progressive movements in Myanmar and beyond Myanmar that fight for the freedom of Myanmar are still very much allergic to the word Rohingya. They're afraid of bringing the Rohingya word up. But ever since the military coup, let me give you a specific example. A few years ago at the University of Sydney, the university that I went to, I think it might have been around 2015, 2016, I went to a stall, and the stall was Burmese societies. There are many societies at university. And I went there, I introduced myself, and they said, oh, you're from Myanmar. I said, yeah. And I said, I'm a Rohingya. And all their faces went so sour. They just completely ignored me. And at that point, I realized they didn't accept me as someone from Myanmar, and I should just walk away. I walked away, and then about 2 years ago, this University of Sydney Myanmar Cultural Society held a dialogue with the NUG, with some of the academics working on Myanmar, and the academic that was organizing this conversation called me and said, the Cultural Society said, the most important voice to have on this panel that we're holding is Nur Aziza. And we need to make sure we have a Rohingya voice. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, from 20, 2016, where I was rejected, to them saying that the Rohingya are the most important voice. And then when I went, there was, after I spoke, there was a line of Burmese students waiting to apologize to me, crying, saying, "We're so sorry we didn't speak up about the Rohingya," because people realized after the military coup, the military will not spare anyone. They are targeting the entire country. So a free Rohingya doesn't just mean free Rohingya. A free Rohingya means freeing all the ethnic groups that are being targeted, Kachin, Chin, Karen, and the entire Myanmar group. And so just because I want to highlight some of the positive attributions that I've seen to not make it so depressing.
Yeah. But
yes, we cannot also ignore the larger spectrum of it where there is large denial. Beyond the denial, there's a lot of, we're done speaking about the Rohingya. It's not just the Rohingya being targeted. The entire country is being targeted. Why is it just the Rohingya? I've heard this so many times now.
Yeah. And I think what you're saying is mirroring what I've heard from many ethnic groups around the country that, you know, I spoke to some of my students who are ethnic minorities, and after the coup they were saying that, you know, the Bama have started apologizing to us for not believing us. And it was kind of an eye-opener for me because I was getting Western media even when I was living in Myanmar, so I was just aware that the military does all these things. And I just assumed that all of my students, for example, who speak English because I teach them English, would also have access to this information and would also accept, just as a matter of course, that, well, yes, the military does all of these terrible things in the ethnic regions. And so I had to come to terms with the fact that no, most of these people were in complete denial. And they just assumed that the Shan, the Kachin, the Karen, the Kareni, and so on and so forth would just make up stories and claimed, oh, the military is shelling villages again or doing air raids on churches again. And so, you know, they love to make up stories. It's like, you don't make up a bomb crater. Like, it doesn't just appear from one day to the next.
Correct. 700,000 Rohingya don't just appear in a refugee camp for no reason.
Exactly. Yeah, you didn't just all decide to go on a holiday to Bangladesh at the same time.
And that, we can talk about Malaysia and Indonesia as well. I always say Rohingya in Malaysia are not fleeing to Bali to enjoy a 5-star hotel.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. It's absolutely absurd. But I think, obviously, as I said before, the mental desire is there to convince yourself that everything is okay so that you don't have to feel like you have complicity or you have a duty to act. It's always easier to just say, well, other people are lying. And I think, you know, we see this even in small cases when there are allegations of, you know, indecent conduct and things like this, whether it's in the workplace or in the school or family, what have you. People just want to convince themselves that allegations are false so that they don't have to take action, so they don't have to take any responsibility. But that's the darker side of human nature there. But on the positive side of human nature, the ICJ case is continuing, and in an interesting turn, we saw this years ago, the ICJ decided that it was the delegation specifically from the junta that they thought would be appropriate to defend this case, not the delegation proposed by the NUG. And so whatever impact that may or may not have for the future recognition of the military regime, the ICJ now has the opportunity to put the military on the stand and ask them to justify their actions, which they appear to be trying to do quite badly. So what can you tell us about the ICJ case, both in terms of where the case itself is at, but also in terms of what impact this case is having on the discourse around the Rohingya genocide more broadly?
Right, just to give the audience a little bit of context. So in 2019, the Gambia, a very small country in Africa, they brought this case to the International Court of Justice against Myanmar, the military in particular. So the case is ongoing, and in 2020, the court provided provisional measures to Myanmar. And some of the provisional measures were to prevent genocidal acts against the Rohingya, to preserve evidence, and to report back regularly to the court. So that alone is crucial because it means the world's highest court has said that there is a plausible risk of genocide. So that being said, it means that this is a legal threshold being met. Mm. Now, did the military listen to the provisional measures? No, they did not. They continued with their violence. They did not preserve any evidence. And the Myanmar argued that because the Gambia was a non-injured state, that they should not have brought this case forward. But the ICJ rejected this claim. And we changed international laws. The Rohingya case set a precedent for other genocides, for other states to intervene. Mm. And I think this is crucial because now the ICJ is saying that the Genocide Convention belongs to everyone. Even if you have rendered an entire people stateless, we still have the opportunity to get our rights back and make sure that justice is being served. Now, what's especially important, what I want to highlight is who pushed this case forward. We don't have a large public movement or public support, unfortunately. We're not Palestine. And the Rohingya case set a precedent for the Palestinian case as well. South Africa was only able to intervene after we changed the international law for non-injured states to intervene. And I think that's something we also need to acknowledge. The case was not driven by any global outrage or public pressure. A lot of the vital work is being done by organizations like mine. It was driven by the survivors and advocates who spent years documenting these crimes and collecting testimonies and pushing states to act when a lot of the Myanmar movement and the entire world movement was completely silent. I think we need to acknowledge that this was pushed by survivors themselves. Now, I've been watching the case move forward during the week. I've been watching snippets of it here and there, and I've watched the Gambia lawyers speak and bring some really intense testimonies. There was one of the lawyers in the Gambia side stating that they, a Rohingya woman saw her nieces and nephews being taken away, and the military created fires, like circles of fires, and they threw the children in the fire alive. And another testimony I heard was about the Sitagu encouraged Buddhist military to kill the animals, aka Rohingya Muslims, and that in Buddhism, to kill a human is a sin, but to kill Rohingya is not a sin, because we are animals and we don't know what's right and what's not right. So he encouraged this, and he made speeches at different military bases to encourage the killing of Rohingya. And then I also heard the hearing from the Myanmar side, and they always say the same lies, same scapegoat tactics, saying that they were tackling extremism and terrorism. I don't know about you, but the Rohingya child being thrown in the fire, I don't know if that's tackling terrorism at all. But, yeah, I don't give them too much time and space. But the lead, let me get the name up for you, the lead lawyer, leading lawyer of the Myanmar case, his name is Christopher Staker. So he's the head of Myanmar's legal team siding with the military. Mm. Important to highlight he's the same lawyer defending Israel. So his professional record includes standing with regimes committing genocide in Myanmar and Palestine, shielding perpetrators while Rohingya and Palestinian civilians are paying the cost. So these elite lawyers are protecting criminals like Netanyahu and Min Aung Hlaing to act without any consequence.
I mean, it's quite grotesque. We've seen this with the legal team. We've seen this with PR firms, even, who were trying to rehabilitate the image of the military post-coup. Until you know, sanctions made it impossible for them to get their salaries, and then all of a sudden they disappeared because they don't actually care what they do or don't do. They just care about being paid for it. But it's quite sad that there are scumbags for hire who will take on these types of cases. The one issue and concern that we have, of course, is that this whole case is being tried in the ICJ, whose jurisdiction does not actually cover genocide. That would have to be handled by the ICC, which Myanmar, for obvious reasons, is not a party to, and they've precluded that. So it's fascinating to watch it, because ostensibly this is a case brought by Gambia on behalf of the state of Bangladesh against the state of Myanmar, and yet everyone understands that this is a proxy trial for an actual trial on the Rohingya genocide, and for matters that should have been deferred to the ICC but can't be. So it's a very fascinating legal case, as you say, a very fascinating legal precedent that can be set, that going forward, hiding from the ICC by withdrawing from the Rome Statute doesn't mean that you can't face consequences. If you send victims and you send refugees across the border, then we can still launch a case in the ICJ against you, and we can still try you by proxy, if that's a term we can use, for genocide. So that is a very good thing to see. But what is not good to see is ASEAN's response. Now, I know that you have accused ASEAN of a certain degree of complicity, and more importantly, of silence. And this is surprising, because when we look at countries like Malaysia, Malaysia is a predominantly Muslim country. Malaysia was taking the lead back in 2021 against the military coup. The foreign minister, Saifuddin Abdullah, did quite a bit as ASEAN chair. And what I've heard from Burmese people, is that they are treated quite poorly in Malaysia because of their association with the Rohingya genocide and because of the association of Islamophobia. And yet, if what I'm hearing from you is correct, the treatment of the Rohingya themselves in Malaysia and Indonesia, also a large majority Muslim country, is really not that good. What can you tell us about that complicated relationship there?
Yeah. So I'll speak about the public in ASEAN, the body itself. I mean, if we speak about ASEAN, they keep using the non-interference mechanism, whatever they want to call it, as an excuse to ignore the Rohingya genocide. There is, you know, in practice, that has meant silence in the face of ongoing atrocity. Rohingya belong in ASEAN. ASEAN issued statements, frameworks, and so-called five-point consensus after the coup, but it completely failed to stop violence, failed to protect civilians, failed to center Rohingya voices. There is no documentation in any of the ASEAN documents that even say the word Rohingya. And I promise you that. And even when I do meet with members from the ASEAN organization, it seems like they want to run away from the Rohingya issue. They want to bury it down to the ground. We can also speak about the economic ties of ASEAN countries with the military junta. Myanmar, private sector, Petronas were doing business with the military. Amnesty International found ports of ships of delivery, gas and oil delivery from Penang to Yangon. And we publicized this report, and we received so much hate from Malaysia, saying that we should be grateful that the Rohingya are given a home in Malaysia. But then there's also the racism that comes with it. I mean, I lived as a refugee in Malaysia for about 8.5 years. And let me tell you, that was not a beautiful period of my life. I was just a child, but I was constantly hiding from the police in the jungles. I didn't go to school until I resettled to Australia. I couldn't even speak Rohingya because we were so afraid to be identified as Rohingya. There is a criminalization of Rohingya refugees. We are being punished for escaping genocide. Last year alone, at the end of last year, 280 Rohingya drowned at sea near Malaysia. And they, because that could have been easily prevented. Malaysia knows that these boats arrive every single year, but there is no safe disembarkation. There is no policy in place to protect the most persecuted people in the entire world, according to the United Nations. But in terms of the public, there is paid hate speech, misinformation, disinformation against Rohingya in the region. And we saw this during the Indonesian presidency, during election time. You know, I'd open Instagram and there was so much hate, and they paid like social media people. What do you call people with a lot of followers? Sorry, I'm getting old.
Those influencers.
Yeah. They paid influencers with a lot of following in Indonesia to spread hate speech against Rohingya. There were made up videos of Rohingya eating a lot of food, saying they were receiving free food from NGOs. There was also racism, saying that we were black refugees, dark refugees. Like in Indonesian, it's called hitam. So they would write hitam, these refugees. And then this manifested into actual violence. There was a group of Achenese students that went to an underground area where Rohingya refugees were seeking shelter in after escaping the genocide. And these group of university students, there were videos of them yelling at the refugees saying, go back, piss off, like, don't stay here. And then it was all over the news. And it created animosity and hatred between us.
And Aceh being the Muslim stronghold even within Indonesia, which is itself a predominantly Muslim country.
Correct. And, you know, they have their own economic issues. We don't deny that.
Mm.
But it is so easy to point fingers at the most vulnerable people. It's so easy to do that. And a lot of them know about the genocide. Like, I've been to Aceh a couple of times now, but there are also very kind Achenese people who are fighting against this hatred. So what we did is we stepped up and we did social cohesion projects on the ground, cultural events. We went there, we told our stories, artwork, this, that, all sorts of various modes of social cohesion. And then we also went to Malaysia, and we have a documentary on this specific issue of hate in ASEAN, and we interviewed people on the road, and there was one interview that I'll never forget, and it's on the documentary as well. We approached this Muslim man, this Muslim wife, Muslim children, and we didn't tell him we were Rohingya. Yeah, we were like, have you heard of the Rohingya? He said yes. And we said, what do you think of them? He said, they should not come. They should not be here. They should go back to Myanmar. And then we said, why? He said, we have our own problems, blah, blah, blah. You know, the classic,
yeah.
We have our own problem. We need to sort out and shit, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end we said, you know, the Rohingya facing persecution, blah. And we gave him a little bit of a lecture, and then we revealed that we were Rohingya. And his face completely drifted. He was shocked. Also, we asked him if he had met a Rohingya before we revealed we were Rohingya. And he said, no, I've never met a Rohingya. So there's the xenophobia,
yeah.
Fear of the unknown. And then he apologized to us then. He said, I'm so sorry, I didn't know. but it was such a good video to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got so many stories of Malaysians being anti-Rohingya, where I'm afraid of my life constantly. And it's sad because they've been one of the largest movements for Palestine. Mm. So they can understand Palestine and they can understand Rohingya, which is much more closer in proximity, and we belong in the region.
I mean, it's really disappointing to see, because again, the irony is that it goes both ways. They'll be racist against the Rohingya, but then they'll also be racist against the Bama for having been racist against the Rohingya in the first place. So it seems that it more so just comes down to a general sense of xenophobia and my team versus your team than it does an actual internally consistent moral position or social position or political position. It's just more, I don't like anyone who's involved in anything outside of my country and I'd rather you not be here, which does sort of explain quite a bit. But on the religious thing, I want to bounce back a little bit to the Buddhism, because the stuff you were saying is patently insane. To be honest, like, you can't, like, the military, I've said this for a long time, the military's version of Buddhism is not Buddhism. The military's version of Buddhism is a weird pseudo-Buddhist cult thing that has no logical theology to it. It's just crazy. And this idea that, well, the Rohingya animals, you could kill them. Even in Buddhism, you can't just kill animals either. So it's fascinating to me, and I think fascinating to a lot of people, how Buddhist theology could be used to justify a genocide when there is categorically nothing within Buddhist theology that would permit that. And yet the religion was still weaponized, not just by the military. That's one thing. Their belief system is insane. And archaic and all of these ridiculous things that they're into. But even among the average Burmese people, you know, you have what's his name? Uwiratu going out and saying all these things about how the Muslims are an existential threat to Myanmar. I remember being in Shan State, and this was during a flare up in the conflict between the Shan State Army and the Tamado. And I asked them, like, hey, are you worried about this conflict here in Shan State? And she's like, oh, look, it's a problem, but it's okay. The real problem in the country is the Muslims. And I was shocked. I'm like, you could not be further from Rakhine if you tried. and yet, like, I know that there is a Muslim population in Shan, but they're a very different population. And my understanding is that they're generally quite wealthy, and so they're disliked for being wealthy. But this is the sort of thing, like, the weaponization of Buddhism, like, how does that happen? How does someone not stand up and go, hang on? Like, if the Buddha were here today, he would smack you because the things you're saying are just crazy. And nobody seems to have done that. Nobody, or some people did, but a lot of people just went along with it and said, this isn't about Buddhist theology. This is about team Buddhism against team Muslim. And that's that. And the 969 movement, and then later Mabata, and all these hate groups, and you were talking about, you know, Sitagusteado. All of these people and all these groups were just able to twist Buddhism into a tool of exclusion and discrimination and just violence. And then, of course, now we have the Buddhist majority countries, you know, places like Thailand and Cambodia and Laos, who also seem to be completely indifferent to the Rohingya plight and partnering with the military on top of that. How do you have any insight into how that could have happened, how they were able to do this?
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Mabata, for example. What did they do to incite such high level of hate against Rohingya? And it starts at a very early age for children of Myanmar. The Mabata group is an extremist Buddhist, we can even call them a cult, really. They go around Myanmar and they go to Buddhist schools, literally children as young as kindergarten, preschool, and they tell the children that Rohingya own cows in our homeland because we're practicing to kill them. Now, I don't think there is anything in Buddhist theology that permits committing genocide, ethnic cleansing, and dehumanization. And I think the core of Buddhist teachings prohibit killing and hatred and stripping of dignity. But this group is very much brainwashing children at such a young age. And when you do that, you create a generation of people that hate the Rohingya. And I wouldn't be surprised if we already have a generation of people hating on the Rohingya from that particular action that the Mabutha did. So what happened in Myanmar, I would say it's not Buddhism. It is the weaponization of religious identity that we see in many different religions, not just Buddhism. But Buddhism is a bit of a shock to our system, yeah? When I tell people about this, they're like, oh, like, extremist Buddhists?
Yeah.
So that shift is crucial. We need to talk about the actions that they did to utilize Buddhism as a tool to justify the violence, and that it happens in every religion. So for me, I mean, like you spoke about the 969 movement and the Mabutha. These are political projects, and they just hide it using the robes. I mean, they preach that Muslims are invaders, that we're breeders, we're a threat to Buddhism. And it's not just Rohingya Muslims facing a threat in the country. Other Muslim groups in Myanmar are also facing this threat. And a lot of Muslim groups in Myanmar are so afraid of being identified as Rohingya because they don't want to face the human rights violations that we face. And then Sitagul, I speak about Sitagul a lot because I was listening to a lot of the work, the disgusting work that he's done at the ICJ case, where he invoked selective historical or religious references to justify violence, implicating that killing could be morally acceptable under certain conditions. Because Rohingya are animals, Rohingya are not humans. And that gave permission to ordinary Burmese, Bama, Buddhists to accept it. Because this very respected senior monk has told the wider Burmese that this is acceptable. And that's how he spreads beyond the Rakhine ethnic group. And, you know, I ask Burmese groups when I meet with them, when we do our truth-telling process, usually I'm in a room with a big group of students from Myanmar in exile, some are ethnic groups, some are Bama. And then I ask them, I said, hands up if you've heard from your family members that Rohingya do not belong in Myanmar and that Rohingya are animals, we are black, we are this, we are that. And you'll see maybe 99% of their hand up the whole time. And I do it not for me. I do it for them. I do it so they can look at each other and realize that there's a commonality in that everybody's falling for this hate and the link of religious, of Buddhism to justify the killings of Rohingya. So, yeah, I hope that answered your question. So
it does. And I think it's a very valuable insight and a very valuable take on it, because as you say, in the West, it was presented as a joke. You know, John Oliver played it for laughs, the idea of extremist Muslims, because it's so shocking. But once we realize that it doesn't matter whether it's an identity or whether it's a culture or a language group or a regional group or anything else, anything that you can identify yourself with, you can use to draw a line and define an us versus a them. And it doesn't matter whether, you know, this is a teaching that is ostensibly focused on pacifism and charity and compassion, it's irrelevant. You know, to take from the Futurama line, the world will learn of our peaceful ways by force. And the irony is thick, but people care more about my group versus everyone else than they do about the actual teaching that was supposed to define their group in the first place. And it's, again, it's just that fundamental weakness of human nature shining through. So on that somber note, let's talk about the positives. So as you've said, the Rohingya population are living in predominantly a combination of refugee camps and exile. And even in those camps, so we had the fortune of interviewing someone quite recently, from the camps in Bangladesh. And he was saying that, well, the Rohingya continue to face discrimination within, you know, within camps. And he himself was actually Rohingya Christian, so he faced discrimination, from other Rohingya as well. And so the problem continues, and there are difficulties in, you know, getting medical services and legal services and representation and so on. And of course, as you say, a lot of people are just living in hiding because they can't risk being found. But you are involved with support projects for that. Your Maya Finder Foundation, obviously, is a key part of that. So I want to understand a little bit more about the work that you do with the foundation and what types of support you are able to give and what types of support need to be provided still so that these people living in camps and the people living in exile and people living in hiding have a chance and have an ability to try to normalize and get the things like education and healthcare and legal rights that they need.
Yeah, sure. So we're a civil society organization. I like foundation, though. You make us sound fancy. I should start introducing it as a foundation. Yeah. So we named our organization in our language, Maya Finer, which means of women in our language, to combat cultural erasure. So part of the genocidal campaign was to remove our language and to make sure the next generation of Rohingya do not know how to speak Rohingya. Mm-hmm. And because of the displacement of Rohingya, we have many Rohingya children who cannot speak Rohingya, who do not know about their own history or their own identity. Now, the Rohingya, let's talk about, so there are 3 million and only 1% live in freedom and carry an identity. The 99% are in refugee camps, in exile. So the refugee camp in Bangladesh, there are refugee camps in Indonesia, there are Rohingya in Thailand in hiding and in detention. There are about 200,000 Rohingya refugees in Malaysia as well, in detention and in hiding. There are Rohingya in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, and in other neighboring countries, in Sri Lanka. I went to visit them. And these are, I mean, the life in the camp in particular is so difficult. It's so grueling. You have children that are turning to sex work just to give food to their younger siblings. Because of the global humanitarian funding cut, Rohingya refugees are living on $12 a month. That's about 20 cents a day. So, of course, we're going to see an increase of desperation. So we have a couple of programs in the camp. One of the programs that we have is a sewing machine program called Threads of Resilience, where we use the sewing machine as a tool for Rohingya women to reclaim their identity, to give them a skill set. So when funding cuts do occur, they're able to bring some money back home. They're able to sell materials, but also to give them a little bit of hope and some sense of normality in their life. So we've trained girls to do this. Mm-hmm. We've got elderly, like elder women training younger women to do this, and it's been quite successful. We've provided humanitarian aid to more than 3,000 families that escaped the violence in the last year and a half with food, aid, In terms of Indonesia, there are 7 Rohingya refugee camps. And what's happening is UNHCR stated an 80% increase of Rohingya arrivals in the last year and a half, given the desperation and the violence has increased. And 75% of the arrival are women and children. So last year, 6 Rohingya women made that perilous journey across the Andaman Sea. And the Indonesian human trafficker raped all 6 of them. And they arrived in Aceh pregnant. And as you know, Aceh has strict Sharia laws, so access to abortion was beyond impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to step up and provide care for them and provide safe housing, provide them with psychosocial support, and so on. And we've continued to do this until today. They've given birth to the children. And until today, the perpetrator of this rape is still on the loose and is living in freedom. We provide psychosocial support for 81 unaccompanied Rohingya children in Aceh as well. A lot of these children witnessed their parents drown where they were clinging onto debris and they couldn't save their parents. Yeah. And we know that we had to step up and provide care to these children that are so vulnerable and where they've just completely been forgotten. Beyond all the on-the-ground care that we do, it's important to highlight that some of us in the team carry passports, which is gold for our community, to be able to travel and attend meetings to tell people the stories of Rohingya is a privilege, and it's a responsibility that we carry as survivors. So we do advocacy in ASEAN, and beyond ASEAN, we also attend high-level meetings at the UN. We were at the Rohingya high-level meeting in New York. We were at the Global Refugee Forum. And it's women that are doing this essential work. And it's not a change. We've always seen this. Rohingya women have always stepped up to provide care for the communities. It was the women that carried their children from Rakhine State to keep their children alive all across to Bangladesh. And we need to acknowledge that. So, yeah, we started with a team of 4 Rohingya women. Today we are a team of 13 fierce, strong Rohingya women that are so capable of doing the work for the community.
But, I mean, you must be stretched incredibly thin, considering just the sheer scale. And from the sound of it, it seems that there's no community of Rohingya living anywhere who are free of the trauma, who are free of the suffering, the associated, you know, the poverty, the legal sidelining of what you said, like 3 million people. It seems that the overwhelming majority of those people are in need of psychosocial services, legal services, and just frankly in need of food and shelter. Is there any way to sort of expand what you're doing? Is it possible for people to volunteer? Is it possible for people to help?
Of course, yeah, definitely. We have people to help us with the work. You know, the organization is led by Rohingya women, but it's for everyone. The freedom of Rohingya cannot be retrieved without women leading. And I truly believe that because we've seen in history that men leading just does not work. And can you imagine, like, men trying to organize dialogue, reconciliation process, blah, 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 in the border of Myanmar and Thailand and having a peaceful 3-day dialogue in a house? It was women that did that. We managed to do that successfully.
Yes. No, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it for a second. I think violence is so often sort of outsourced to men, right? We're the ones who do the violence, we're the ones responsible for that. And it I don't know, the way that we as men seem to react to the existence of violence is kind of un unhealthy at times. I think we either react to it positively and we're in support of it, or we try to deny that it happened, or we try to justify that it happened. There's always got to be a very strong emotive reaction to the existence of violence. We're not able as much, I think, just across the board. I mean, obviously there will be exceptions, but I think typically with men, it's when violence happens, we're far more likely to just focus on the violence itself instead of focusing on solutions to the violence or avoidance from the violence or ways that we can go forward. And I do think that women do a significantly better job at being more, what is the word I'm looking for here, socially oriented, community oriented, and less focused on saying, okay, where do we allocate the blame, and more focused on saying, how do we dig ourselves out of this hole? Again, obviously it's a generalization. There will be exceptions on all sides, but I do agree that as a general trend, the cooler heads in highly tense, violent situations will usually be women's.
Correct. I agree. I've been doing this work for nearly a decade now, and I just, you know, having a team of 13 Rohingya women is much less lonelier than doing this work alone at the beginning of this work. And we can only do this work as a collective. And we have bright Rohingya women that are more than capable. You know, in our team we have lawyers, we have doctors, we have teachers, nurses, and they can all provide their knowledge to make sure that when we talk about the democracy of Myanmar, we truly mean it. Because we can call, yeah, I mean, we can talk about the quasi-democratic period between 2011 to 2021, and that did not include any Rohingya voices, and violence against Rohingya still occurred.
Yep. Absolutely it did. But talking about Myanmar, and this is sort of in sort of coming towards the conclusion of our discussion here, this is the million-dollar question. Obviously, the Rohingya are not being accepted anywhere. That's just a fact, right? No one is accepting the Rohingya with open arms. And there's a very reasonable desire, I think, on the part of many Rohingya to return to their homes, where they're from and their ancestors were from, going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, despite what the military propaganda would say. And the Arakan army is this strange factor that's very difficult to really comprehend and see through. They're not known for their reliability, neither is the Damodar, but they're not, you know, hopefully they're not going to be the ones in power soon. The Arakan army have made overtures towards peace. They have made these vague statements that they would be willing to see the Rohingya return to their homes, and they'd be willing to establish a sort of return to, let's say, pre-1942 status quo. How do you feel about the idea of a large-scale repatriation of Rohingya to their former homes? And how do you feel about the Arakan army as being changed of heart and willing to sort of be open to the Rohingya and be friendly once more? Do you see that as realistic? Do you see that as earnest, or are you skeptical?
Oh, I'm definitely skeptical. Absolutely skeptical. I mean, you can ask many Rohingya, even myself. We have a very deep connection to our ancestral homeland. This is the homeland that our grandfathers built our houses in. Our grandmothers grew our food. We have historical mosques that were burnt to the ground. So the desire of Rohingya to return home is very genuine and very reasonable. So we were not asking to go somewhere new, not asking to go to places where our families lived for generations long before the modern Burmese state existed. You know, most of us want to go back home. But to go back home, there are a few implementations that need to occur. Truth-telling and a reckoning process. You cannot return a persecuted group back to their homeland without having this process. And we see that in different places around the world, like Indigenous Australia, for example.
Mm.
But we want to return with dignity and safety. And we've spoken about repatriation so many times over the years, and it's all been unsuccessful. There were Rohingya that were sent as a trial and they came back straight away because the conditions don't exist. So the return cannot happen without citizenship or full legal status, physical security and protection, the restoration of our homes, livelihoods and land. You know, in 2017, our homes were taken away and given to Rakhine ethnic group, just like that. And then we were placed in IDP camps far away from the faces of Myanmar, away from the capital city of Sitwe in Akyem. And these IDP camps are horrendous. We need the freedom of movement and the accountability of past crimes. I mean, the Arakan army, I don't have much hope, to be frank with you.
Mm-hmm.
The suggestion of openness and Rohingya returned are all lies. The Arakan army, their motive is to clear Rohingya away. Their motives is the same as the military junta. You know, on paper, it looks pretty and cute and sexy, but we've learnt and we've seen the violence occur over the years. So the statements that they've made are vague. They're not backed by legal frameworks. They're not following international laws. So this doesn't mean that dialogue is impossible. We've done it. We've done it with Rakhine ethnic groups. But the trust is very low. And we have very good reasons why the trust is very low. So my skepticism is not cynicism. It's really what I've seen in the last year and a half and what I've heard. So the Arakan army, they don't have the political legitimacy, or they don't even have institutional capacity or international recognition when they are conducting the genocide. We cannot play nice with an armed group that have raped, murdered, killed women and children. And that's something that the Rohingya community can never forget.
Yeah. And so this raises the follow-up question. What do you see as a viable pathway forward? Because either the Rohingya have to simply be given citizenship and settlement rights in the places where they currently reside, which would require a lot of states simultaneously to change their policies and would be a pretty significant impact on Bangladesh in particular. Or there has to be some sort of way for the Rohingya to repatriate, but under a completely changed system of governance and oversight within Rakhine that does not depend on the Arakan army self-policing. So what do you see as a viable way forward?
I mean, right now, it might be too early to tell, but the Rohingya should not be asked to gamble their lives on goodwill alone.
Mm.
I think we've done that for a very long time. And the NUG, for example, we know Aung San Suu Kyi is a genocide denier, and I'm just going to say it, she's a racist. There was an interview where the BBC, a Muslim woman, interviewed her and asked her about the Rohingya, and she was flustered. She was so angry. And then she took a break, and she didn't realize the mic was on. It wasn't turned off. And what she said was, "I didn't know that I would be interviewed by a Muslim woman." And then this was pasted all over the media. So we can't wait for people to perfect the politics in Myanmar, because we're just going to lose another generation of Rohingya in the camps, in detention, in limbo. So we need a couple of tracks. We need immediate protection and legal status where Rohingya are now, and we need to be part of this dialogue. Rohingya were very much part of the movement for the freedom of Myanmar and the democratization of Myanmar post-colonial periods. But we don't have any Rohingya representation beside like one person in the NUG. So we need meaningful representation, especially of women. But again, we can also go back to the conditions. So realistically, I would say protection in legal status is number one. And we also need to talk about the repatriation of Rohingya from the IDP camps to their ancestral homeland. That's something not many people are speaking about. And accountability and economic pressures. There are many states providing weapons to the junta and other mini Minaulangs. We could talk about Russia, China, India, Singapore, Thailand, Malaysia. These are all states that are contributing to the genocide of the Rohingya, that are killing my people, that are responsible of making me a stateless person. So yeah, I mean, there's no direct answer to your question, but there's different prongs that needs to be worked on to ensure that it's meaningful and that it's viable, because everybody talks about the Arakan army being in charge or having Rohingya having their own state, la-di-da-di-da. We can talk about all of that, but then we need to have implementations in place.
Absolutely. And it is difficult, and there are so many different ideas and suggestions for how that could be done, but all of them depend on a lot of people.
I mean, really, the viable pathway forward is the one that stops treating Rohingya lives as disposable and temporary, and treating our rights, Rohingya rights, as non-negotiable at all.
Yeah. The only difficulty is that historically the oppressing class does not grant rights to the oppressed class voluntarily. That is a great rarity in history. They usually have to be compelled in some way, shape, or form, either internally or externally. But those in power do not generally just give up that power and that prestige just because they felt
magnanimous. No, it's like buy one, get one free situation.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a bleak situation, and it's always sort of like this when we have to talk about oppressed groups. But I mean, that's it. Like, you know, it can't be puppies and rainbows all the time. This is the reality, and this is what people are facing, and this is why we need to take action, and this is why we need to be so aware that the Rohingya genocide is not a thing that just happened and then ended, and now we don't have to worry about it anymore. It is an ongoing crisis, and it is a worsening crisis in a lot of dimensions. And I'm very grateful that you're able to come on, and I'm sure it's very difficult to sort of relive a lot of those memories, but I'm very grateful that you can share them for the benefit of the audience who can be aware now of how serious and how severe the ongoing suffering is in the Rohingya community globally. And I encourage you to say whatever you feel.
I want to end it by saying that Rohingya cannot do this work alone. We need everyone to step up, whether you call yourself an advocate, whether you're an academic, whether you work at a supermarket, whether you're a teacher, it doesn't matter. Because a collective amnesia will never end a genocide. And this is exactly why this genocide is prolonged, because collective amnesia has been normalized. So everybody needs to play their part, and everybody has a part to play in ending mass atrocities.
kala sangolare mala tetture de tu mala.
Thank you for listening to this episode in full. You know, by this point, we've aired a few hundred episodes with so many more scheduled, and every one of them is available at no charge. We're committed to keeping our platform freely accessible into the foreseeable future so that anyone, anywhere can learn more about the situation in Myanmar. At a time when keeping global awareness on the country is so critical, it's more important than ever to share these stories widely. So to ensure that we can continue offering these programs without any barriers or paywalls in the way, we've launched a membership program. Becoming a member not only helps us sustain this platform and bring you more vital interviews, it also comes with benefits like advanced releases, behind-the-scenes content, exclusive discounts at our shop, and more. So if you'd like to support us and gain access to these perks in the process, visit insightmyanmar.org/membership to learn more. Thank you for being a part of this mission. Of course, we also welcome contributions of any kind as well, and please consider visiting insightmyanmar.org/donation to learn more about the ways that you can contribute.
Yarananga yaunya na dadu ya dana biori ganesa dumana wigara besayana besayo. Oba yarananda dayananga na yarananya dayarananga poda ba yarananga.